put our feet up and began to obstinately enjoy our Real Housewives television programming and our Twinkies. I feel this profoundly, for I love a Twinkie. We have been occasionally made, with reluctance, to pause the programming of luxury long enough to look out the window and witness some persevering injustice or other, which is a total pain, right? We've been made to acquiesce the right to vote in our elections to people like ladies and also dark-skinned people. Ugh, fine. Can we please get back to the Dukes of Hazzard now? This episode is amazing. They jump the General Lee over three creeks and Sheriff Roscoe P. Coltrane's police cruiser. Plus, that lady has an amazing butt. So successfully exploited that tiny denim shorts came to be known as Daisy Dukes. This diversion is top drawer. I think we can hold as self-evident the truth that Ben Franklin, having been shown to possess a love of humor as well as a fascination with farts, would have been a great fan of my television program, Parks and Recreation. I believe, furthermore, that he would have enthusiastically approved of modern viewing systems, by which we can watch the programming of our choosing at whatever time we prefer. This luxury allows me to budget my time accurately, allowing for 1 or 2 hours in an evening devoted to Downton Abbey or Jimmy DiResta videos on YouTube. Unlike the TV viewing of my youth, I am no longer required to watch anything I don't fully choose. If I wanted to watch Happy Days at 8 and Three's Company at 9, I had to sit through some bullshit called Laverne and Shirley at 8:30. That's not the best example, since Laverne and Shirley was fantastic, but you get the idea. I believe that Mr. Franklin would have enjoyed the small percentage of television programming that is not garbage, much as I do. Particularly if he had taken some beer on board, transporting himself halfway to Concord. For he takes a very inspiring position on the topic of leisure versus laziness. Bear witness. Employ thy time well, if thou meanest to gain leisure. Leisure is time for doing something useful. This leisure the diligent man will obtain, but the lazy man never. I believe the difference in the two conditions described above, leisure and laziness, is one of intent. Franklin is instructing us to live diligently, working at our vocations to raise an income in such a way as to leave a remnant of time for more leisurely pursuits. In my own life, these pursuits can include hiking, woodworking, television, reading for pleasure, walking by the ocean with my wife, playing with our dogs, listening to records, playing my guitar, etc. These are all activities for which I earmark periods of time, as opposed to just randomly thinking, I have 3 hours to kill, what should I do now? Conversely, I feel like laziness requires a strong inclination to passivity. I know that among my human attributes, I definitely have the potential for laziness. That's when we think, ugh, this bed feels so nice, I don't want to do anything. The trouble with this human inclination is that, as poor Richard says, the sleeping fox catches no poultry. A refrain I have heard from young people my whole life, usually delivered in a plaintive whine, has been, I'm bored, there's nothing to do. Franklin's guidance is precisely apposite to this particular complaint, as he is counseling us to fill our time with something useful. Which to me means that, if I know I'm going to ride a train for 4 hours, I bring a book. If I finish a project at the woodshop a few hours ahead of schedule, I try something new on the lathe, or ride my bike to Griffith Park, whose mountainous roads are a useful workout indeed. I have learned to use foresight whenever possible to preemptively fill my time so that none shall be wasted. Sometimes I stumble in this effort, but sometimes I am successful, and I know well by now that I will go to bed much better satisfied if I have filled the day's time with productivity instead of the diversions of a lazy person. Positively occupying one's time is also a matter of health, both physical and mental. We must avoid sloth, Franklin adds, for sloth, like rust, consumes faster than labor wears, while the used key is always bright, as poor Richard says. When I have sometimes indulged in sloth, I can, in hindsight, identify how quickly I became depressed, which I, quote-unquote, solved by overindulging in intoxicants, namely weed and bourbon. I have learned that by budgeting my tavern time just as punctiliously as I do my work and leisure times, then the libation of my choice, single malt scotch these days, becomes a temperate dose of medicine against the stress of the week, rather than a constant dulling agent. There's a great anecdote in Franklin's autobiography about one of his first jobs working at a London printing press as a young man. The work was incredibly physical, as I would imagine, hauling heavy trays of type to and fro, upstairs and downstairs. Franklin explains that he drank only water, as he was quite aware of the strenuousness of the exercise involved, while the other workers, the Brits, guzzled beer all day. He was able to carry one tray per hand, while the Englishmen would bear only one tray in two hands, causing them to marvel and dub him the Water American. They wondered how he could appear stronger than they, drinking only water, while they consumed strong beer. Our young American explained to them that there was far more sustenance in a penny's worth of bread than in all that beer, but they would not be convinced. To give you an idea of the quantity and consistency of this consumption, Franklin wrote, "My companion at the press drank every day a pint before breakfast, a pint at breakfast with his bread and cheese, a pint between breakfast and dinner, lunch, a pint at dinner, a pint in the afternoon about 6 o'clock, and another when he had done his day's work. Using my ineluctable powers of arithmetic, I have tabulated that bar tab at 6 pints a day. Now, I don't know about you, but when I'm working hard at physical labor, I can handle a refreshing pint with my lunch, so long as I'm not required to perform any activities requiring precision or finesse. That's 1 pint. The second pint certainly feels good going down, but then the pleasing effect of the elixir's alcohol turns the idea of going back to work to one of misery. That's 2 pints. 6 sounds like a possible problem was at hand." The periods in my life when beer at lunch was de rigueur included my work on a blacktop crew, framing houses, and building scenery for larger Chicago theaters. All jobs as a member of a labor crew, some requiring more skill than others, but as much muscle as anything else. Frequently, some of my fellow laborers would consume beer, or weed or vodka, or all three, with a thirst to match Franklin's printing house compatriots, which I found a bit alarming. Some of them were clearly alcoholics, to the point where we'd stop at the bar on the way to work at 6 a.m., so they could slam a double vodka and fill a cooler with Miller Lite. I tried to join in on this apparent good time, and on much more than one occasion. We managed to get through those years without anybody losing a finger or an arm or a life, but that's just luck and dumb animal fortitude. It turned out that I could haul plywood and framing timber and drive nails in a perfectly acceptable fashion after a couple of one-hitters or a few beers. It was also clear that I needed to lie down in my truck and sleep for 3 hours immediately after getting off work. I'd find a shady spot behind a barn, open the doors for the breeze, and pass out from exhaustion. This seemed fun, maybe the first or even the second time it happened, before I slowly discovered that my days were, on the whole, exceedingly more enjoyable if I wasn't shit-faced while performing extreme feats of physical strength in the hot sun for 8 to 10 hours. I suppose this was my first lesson in moderation, when I began to work sober and then enjoy the drinking only after work so much more. Youth was an important ingredient for me in this high level of consumption, and so, as my years have progressed, so has my tolerance decreased, a statistic which I find to be comforting. One reason I was able to identify the folly, eventually, in such a lifestyle was that it occurred to me that my co-workers had given up. They had resigned themselves to the fact that they would be merely brute laborers for the remainder of their able-bodied lives. Now, this isn't to say that one can't have a rewarding and admirable life pouring concrete or shingling roofs. In fact, I know a great many such tradespeople to whom I look up for doing just that. I often envy these men and women their lives of staunchly task-oriented schedules, requiring only a pickup truck, a set of dependable tools, and some quality materials. I find an undeniable nobility in the men and women who build our houses and buildings and roads and bridges. These particular fellows, however, had thrown in the towel, reducing their aspirations in life to simple dreams of a nicer, slightly less used Camaro, or maybe an extra week at the Wisconsin Dells. I suppose what I'm driving at is this. If you're having drinks on your lunch break from work, you might be in the wrong job. Or you might be in the best job you can lay your hands on, in which case you might be neglecting the time and love you could be spending on your spouse slash kids slash pets. Working as an artist on stage or on camera, or making objects of wood in my shop, I flatly need every bit of sharpness and focus that I can muster. When I'm lucky enough to be engaging in the work I love, the last thing I want to do is put on a buzz which would serve only to cloud my abilities and desecrate my experience. Ben Franklin wrote that when men are employed, they are best contented. For on the days they worked, they were good-natured and cheerful. But on our idle days, they were mutinous and quarrelsome, which put me in mind of a sea captain whose rule it was to keep his men constantly at work. And when his mate once told him that they had done everything and there was nothing further to employ them about, "Oh," says he, "make them scour the anchor." To clarify, scouring the anchor of a ship is a perfectly unnecessary activity, but given the choice between that and having a workforce stand about idling, a good administrator will always set the crew to a task. You'll see this refrain again before my book is done. Find good work to do and get to it. I mentioned earlier, you may recall, having two favorite statements from Benjamin Franklin. The second of the two is not funny at all, but it is the lesson of his that moves me the most to emulation. As a young man returning from England, he wrote out a moral code for himself, which included this: "I resolve to speak ill of no man whatever." Among all of Franklin's advice, I found this instruction to be the most profound, perhaps because it is the simplest. Of course, my mother had said to me as a lad, "If you can't say something nice about a person, don't say anything at all," and of course that had stuck with me, as did a great deal of my mother's beautiful teachings. However, since I can be described as the duplicitous mess known as a human mammal, my nature will, on occasion, steer me in directions that blatantly disagree with my parents' gentle wisdom. Often, I'm able to pull out the map that my mom drew and find my way through the underbrush of my ego back to the path of decency, but having that tutelage reinforced from out of the blue by an American founding father, no less, about whom I was reading simply because I knew there would be some talk of farting and electricity, has been stirring. Like anybody, I am susceptible to insecurity or paranoia upon any given day. When I examine my professional choices, for example, good or bad, or even just a quote in a magazine or a review, I can, if I'm not careful, dive down a rabbit hole of self-doubt. What did that reporter mean by bravely quirky? Was I wrong to have passed on that crime drama? Is Ursine a compliment? But in the end, we're all Americans, and it's been said that we had better hang together, or we shall most assuredly hang separately, or something like that. Beyond that, even, we're all earthlings. I'm afraid that eventually we're going to have to admit that we're all in that together as well, and that Franklin's words hold true on a worldwide level. He knew this when he penned a letter home from Paris in 1777. It is common observation here that our cause is the cause of all mankind, and that we are fighting for their liberty in defending our own. A Parisian contemporary of Ben Franklin's paid him this compliment. He knew how to be impolite without being rude. I love that distinction powerfully. To me, that's one of the most important aspects of working as a giggle pusher, and I know my personal technique still requires some improvement. I hereby vow to maintain this course of study so that I may one day also aspire to fart proudly. Chapter 3. The Scrivener. James Madison. Beyond Masters Washington and Franklin, the list of luminaries and firebrands comprising and surrounding the Founding Fathers is loaded with characters who exhibited a substantial deal of gumption. John Jay, of course, the hot one, John Adams, roundly admired for his marriage to Laura Linney, Alexander Hamilton, who famously attended every meeting with his fly accidentally wide open, even the influential French aristocrat Gilbert du Motier, commonly known as the Marquis de Lafayette or Stinky Pierre, incessantly suggesting that heavier sauces be served with meat dishes, to the great chagrin of colonial chef Dieter Puck, ancestor to Wolfgang. And let's not exclude Thomas Juicy Lowhangers Jefferson, whom I sincerely revere as a vocal proponent of an agrarian society, not to mention everyone knows he smoked a preponderance of his own homegrown hemp. These are just some of the marquee players on the scorecard of our nation's formation, but the list of qualified personages goes on at some length, if the main qualification is gravel. The bench is awfully deep, as it were, with shrewd thinkers and irascible orators, who each brought their own individual flavor packet to this ideological melting pot. That said, it may then come as a surprise to the listener that I have chosen one of the least outwardly colorful or pimpin' founding fathers to round out my initial threesome. James Madison, our fourth president, who is considered the father of the Constitution. He also authored a little brochure known as the Bill of Rights. The primary reason I am drawn to Madison is that, while all these other great scholars and elocutionists were battling out the issues at hand, he was the one writing it all down and personally weaving all these innovative philosophies into the documents that continue to shape and protect our rights as Americans today. Most of the other valuable players were brandishing a powerful complement of charisma in the meeting halls, expressing with eloquence and volume their opinions and policies, which James Madison would then weigh and curate in his writing. To my way of thinking, it was his even-keeled approach and his consummate reportage that allowed the explosive and exciting ideals of our newly hatched country to be most effectively incorporated in a documented way that managed to take root and blossom, even while withstanding the clamorous rancor of opposing viewpoints. A diminutive fellow, tipping the scales at 100 pounds and boasting a mere 5 feet 4 inches from crown to toe, Madison brings to my mind the legendary character actor Bob Balaban, who, in every role, seems quietly dismissible at the get-go, but then proves to carry a presence of magnitude by the time the credits roll. Lacking the height and lung power to perform respectably in a shouting match with his contemporaries, James Madison instead relied upon an unwavering work ethic and commitment to neutrality in his summations. When the blustering had subsided at any constitutional meeting, and the participants, heaving from exertion, undoubtedly leaning upon a handmade walnut tea table with meticulously carved ball and claw feet, regained their respective wins enough to ask, "Did anybody write that down?" Madison was able to relieve the room by reporting that yes, he had recorded every snatch and rejoinder, and then some. His participation went so far as to resemble that of the great and powerful Oz, navigating machinations from behind his curtain for some of our government's greatest initial dramas. For example, when George Washington was elected our nation's first president, Madison wrote his inaugural address, as well as the House of Representatives' congratulatory reply to Washington's address, as well as Washington's reply to the House's reply. Imagine, by the way, how much less ignorant so many of the Bush boys would have appeared if they'd only had Jimmy Madison spinning the rhetoric for both sides of their presidential debates. In much the same sensibility with which they trusted only George Washington to steer the newly launched schooner of American government, the Founding Fathers preferred only James Madison to write up both the captain's orders and the owner's manual. Our fourth president, as we like to bandy in my scholarly circle, was hella smart. In layman's terms, this means he was smart as shit. As shit being rather incongruously employed here as a compliment. Huh. That's not very good writing. Let's examine. Etymologically, I am inclined to think that this rather clumsy usage can likely be traced to the much more accurate phrase, slick as shit, an apt simile comparing a given condition, object, or person favorably to the especially slippery lubricating properties of the digestive waste products of any critter that poops, but traditionally that of the goose, as in, damn, playa, them Jordans are slick as shit. Or, Ryan, come and finish your Capri Sun, and don't run near the pool, it's slippery as goose shit. As our collective human intelligence continues to erode in conversation, even while the sum total of our statistical knowledge on paper increases at an alarming rate, I know that I am certainly guilty of many such verbal lob shots, so that if I want to express an extreme of really any circumstance, I am prone to use as shit. This blacktop is hot as shit. These jalapeno poppers are tasty as shit. Mario Lopez's abs are ripped as shit. And his teeth, glory be, them pearlies are white as shit. You get the picture, I imagine, since you are likely perceptive as shit. I believe I commit these errors with some frequency, an indiscretion I would like to correct going forward, perhaps thanks to an historical vigilance installed in me by my mother and her mother, telling me not to say ain't enough times that it finally stuck. I love words, and I want to use them positively, so I'll need to police myself from here on out, as my grandma Eloise is gone, and I don't see my mom frequently enough for her to save me, which, admittedly, is lame as shit. As I was saying, James Madison was right intelligent. He graduated from Princeton in only 2 years' time, supposedly subsisting on 4 to 5 hours of sleep a night. The man was a compulsive student, first in college and then in the halls of life. He was commonly described as a nose-to-the-grindstone worker, which is another attribute of his that gets me fired up. He saw the work that needed to be done, so he rolled up his sleeves and he did it. Madison understood inherently that men and women love being divided against themselves. In the Federalist Papers, he wrote, "So strong is this propensity of mankind to fall into mutual animosities that where no substantial occasion presents itself, the most frivolous and fanciful distinctions have been sufficient to kindle their unfriendly passions and excite their most violent conflicts." In other words, if things are relatively calm, we the people will come up with any old bullshit to squabble about because it's in our nature. Because deep down, we're dumb as shit. James Madison got it because he was sharp in the noggin or thinking bucket, and so he went on to attest, "The regulation of these various and interfering interests forms the principal task of modern legislation, and involves the spirit of party and faction in the necessary and ordinary operations of the government." By the way, he was about 37 years old when he penned these notions, which might seem more appropriate coming from a wise old sage, like maybe a colonial Dumbledore. This young warlock of a man, one of Virginia's finest minds, was so invested in his share of the responsibilities regarding the drafting of first the Articles of Confederation, then the Constitution, and finally his full authoring of the Bill of Rights, that he risked even life and limb to see him completed in a satisfactory manner. Examine, if you will, the Constitutional Convention. Congress was summoned to Philadelphia to discuss revising the Articles of Confederation. James Madison arrived 11 days early. Oh, hang on. Back up, sorry. This was after Thomas Jefferson sent him two trunks containing 21 books on political histories. Even Thomas Jefferson knew which tiny horse to bet on. Madison was preparing for this dust-up by reading the political histories of the Greeks, the Swiss, the Dutch, and the Germans. I nodded off just writing that list. He was boning up big time while the other congressmen were probably hanging out with Jefferson and Sally Hemings, smoking bongs and getting jiggy with it, whereby jiggy refers to, I think, penis play, and it refers to the female vagina. This was pre-Constitution, remember, so anything goes, or went. Shit was going down like a David Lee Roth video, dressed in the wardrobe and with furniture from Amadeus. Meanwhile, our man was making carnal advances of his own upon his homework in as stiff a fashion as he could muster, utilizing all the myriad mental powers of a brain engorged with blood, like an erect John Thomas. Bringing that metaphor to completion. Let's also remind ourselves that George Washington did not want to attend yet another reunion of his highfalutin, loudmouthed, smarty-pants cohorts. Washington was tuckered out from fathering our nation, and he just wanted to recline on the porch and get his snack on at Mount Vernon. He was obstinate and likely would have succeeded in avoiding the sausage party had not our Mr. Madison hauled his insubstantial fanny to Washington's side and convinced him that his attendance was imperative to the successful carrying of the day. Spoke Madison to Washington, "It was the opinion of every judicious friend whom I consulted that your name could not be spared." Now, I am not saying that I am sitting here ogling some man-on-man Greco-Roman wrestling magazines and singlet headgear catalogs, but if I were enjoying such fare, I may well have Madison to thank for lighting the figurative fire under George, so that he was subsequently able to ensure that such freedoms would one day be mine to enjoy in the comfort of my own domicile. Harumph. To resume, Madison arrived 11 days early. Did he leap about the room, commanding the attention of the assembly with his winning flourishes and fulminations? Did he sing the truths of American democracy into every ear present? Did he run a deep flag pattern, burning Aaron Burr, who stood futilely holding his own jockstrap, while Madison caught a 50-yard toss from General Washington for a game-winning touchdown, resulting in a flamboyant Madison nut grab and moonwalk across the end zone? He did not. He sat close-mouthed as near as he could manage to the action, and he took notes. And because the delegates were sworn to secrecy, his notes actually became the invaluable record of the convention. A note about arriving early. I am of the opinion that if you are habitually late, it is inconsiderate to others and also just inefficient. But I am not here to discuss that particular imprudence. What I am suggesting for myself, if no other, is that being on time is also frequently not good enough if I want to do as good a job as possible. My dad taught me to get there early, case the joint, examine the lay of the land, evaluate the facility, find out where to piss, see if there's a drinking fountain, evaluate the breeze/draft patterns so as to determine the best location from which to stand freely farting and escape detection. What are the pros and cons of the balcony versus the orchestra? I like to experience life, whenever and wherever possible, at a steady pace that some might call laborious. I suppose this makes me much more of the proverbial turtle than the hare, but I firmly believe that slow and steady wins the race. Madison had the perspicacity to roll into Philadelphia with 11 extra days to find his footing, scout the location, canvass the participants, and begin to weigh fairly all the information that was about to be dumped into his lap. Coupled with punctuality, the other meritorious quality in this set of bookends is follow-through. Again, my dad crops up in the mental How to Live Effectively manual that he and my mother painstakingly installed in my toolkit. When I hear the word follow-through, I am immediately reminded of my dad's lessons in shooting a basketball and throwing a baseball and swinging a bat. Follow-through is what produces the backspin on a basketball shot. That stabilizing centrifugal force that allows a greater level of consistency to be realized in one's shooting percentage. The same technique can be applied to any task one undertakes in life, inspired by the idiom, if you're gonna do a job, do it right. Wittingly or no, Mr. Madison was certainly an initiate into this school of practice because his follow-through in regard to the Constitutional Convention was extraordinary, to a degree that can be described only as nothing but net. His commitment to the ultimate American thesis, our Constitution, was superhuman. He refused to leave the site of the historic proceedings, with the single exception of dire visits to the Thunder Closet, overextending himself financially to the point that he was flat broke by the end of the convention. These straits required him to borrow $100 just to get himself to New York, where presumably there would be an ATM at his disposal. Once the convention disbanded and the document was drawn up, it then required ratification or considered approval from the many delegates who had returned to their disparate home states. Madison proceeded to canvass, mainly his home state of Virginia, debating the merits of the fledgling Constitution with his fellow lawmakers, resulting in a successful ratification in the summer of 1788. This taste of victory would prove to be a brief comfort, however, as riding home from a debate at James Monroe's crib that winter, he exposed himself to the elements to the point that he suffered frostbite on the end of his nose. His commitment to the cause of our nation's success left him suitably decorated for life, in the form of a scar on his noble sniffer. So, great. All these erudite honkies had gotten together and come up with a revolutionary new democratic method by which to govern a country, but the finer points needed intense scrutiny before the system could be deemed ready for consumption. In letters he exchanged with Thomas Jefferson, Madison was hell-bent that A, the plan be ratified by the citizenry, B, the people's representation in Congress be based upon population, and C, the power be divided between different branches of government, all of which turned out to be quite potent and effective ideas. I believe he also insisted that D, upon voting, citizens would each receive 3 smokable papers for the rolling of tobacco products only, which never really caught on except in the states of California, Washington, Colorado, Oregon, and Alaska. Along with Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and other less famous white people, Madison fervently campaigned for the newborn Constitution to be approved. They energetically lobbied, visiting fellow congressmen and constituents in person, but the three also published a series of essays in support of the document's ratification, which came to be known as the Federalist Papers. Comprised of 85 originally anonymous essays, the Federalist Papers are considered to be the most influential factor in seeing the Constitution ratified into existence. The most influential, that is, after the 3 factors visible through Hamilton's wide-open barn door. Madison contributed 29 of these written pieces, which contain some of his most quotable sentiments, such as, Those miscreants who break breeze within a shuttered chamber, particularly if there be no draught of exhaust cleansing the vapors of the vestibule, I find to be categorized among the most scurrilous and contumelious of the brute creatures with which Providence has graced this verdant paradise. Or, the clock reads but noon of the day, and yet I am but fatigued near to prostration. I would that our new constitution might foment a climate of creativity, by which our apothecaries might brew me a physic in a tiny vial, for to replenish mine corporeal form with energy, for a surplus of, say, 4 or even 5 hours of time. A 5-hour energy draught, if you will. Much less interesting, but perhaps more poignant to our discussion, is this portion from essay number 51, Madison's most famous quote. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing government, which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. Now, I know what you're thinking. No shit, James Madison. But let me remind you that nobody had thought this crap up before. For spitballing, this was not a bad piece of work. I mean, sure, it seems that he was rather obsessed with angels, creatures of fiction, much the same as fairies and unicorns, but I think he kept it under control enough to focus on the task at hand. Let's just be thankful the Constitution doesn't require any wee folk or thrumpins to command seats of political office. That is, as far as we know. Who can tell what the bylaws of Freemasonry demand? Not me, you silly goose, for I am not a Freemason. Don't be ridiculous. Thanks largely to these efforts by the Federalist Papers authors, the Constitution remained alive, but the work had only just begun for James Madison. Remember that the colonies had just won their freedom from the tyranny of the tea-sipping British monarchy, and so the citizens were very nervous about the amount of power that might be afforded to this new federal government, and with good reason. I mean, we were not about to start a country in which we called the trunk of a car the boot, for fuck's sake. The Bill of Rights came about as a reassurance to the people, to assuage their fears of an overweening central power by asserting their individual rights in writing. James Madison, a.k.a. the Mad Jam, expressed his opinion of this first set of constitutional amendments to be a nauseous project, but he knew that he had to get it together if he wanted the Constitution to happen. One substantial public concern was that by naming certain explicit rights of citizens, other unlisted or crybaby rights might then be limited. These great thinkers, like the Mad Jam, had to take an unimaginable amount of bellyaching on board from all sides and then hold true to their astonishing foresight. They had the Magna Carta as a starting point, sure, and they knew a lot of cool vocabulary words, I get it, but they had to combine all this knowledge, stir in a large scoop of gumption, and thereby concoct the bubbling loaf of our legal system, in which the people are represented directly in the legislation, and crimes would be prosecuted fairly in the judicial system. I don't know about you, but when I have to merely take down burrito orders for the 8 of us at Offerman Woodshop, I grow befuddled and overwhelmed, and the last thing I can think about is making certain that everyone feels fairly represented. Thomas, they were out of carne asada, so I got you a bag of tortilla chips and some tomatillo salsa, and half a churro. Get off my dick. What do you think this is, the Constitutional Convention? You don't like churros? Why don't you move to North Korea? Therefore, the thought of equitably laying out a set of rules by which all Americans could be protected fairly equally beggars my feeble thinking pan. Not only did the Mad Jam manage to accomplish this unappetizing task in the face of ambivalence and opposition, He did it all while running a campaign against his good pal James Monroe for Virginia's seat in the first House of Representatives. In fact, it is widely held that Monroe would well have ridden his slight electoral edge to victory had it not been for the cold efficacy of Madison's slanderous campaign slogan, "Mo Monroe, Mo Problems." A great deal of Sturm und Drang, not to mention blood, sweat, and phlegm, went into the initial sculpting of our governmental system. One of the most progressive aspects of the documentation detailing our newborn government, indeed possibly that decree's most admirable attribute, is the fact that the framers of the Constitution made it fixable. To greatly simplify this notion, the men who wrote the Constitution included the special feature of malleability. If the pronouncements and laws of the American government didn't altogether work for the people, why then the people could change those laws with the help of their representatives. Of 17 proposed amendments to the Constitution, 10 were ultimately approved by Congress and the states. These amendments were written precautions on behalf of the citizenry to safeguard individual liberties and place specific indispensable limits on government power. There has been a lot of talk in this chapter about the rights of the people, and I just want to take a moment to remind us that at this juncture, the people referred quite specifically to white people who happened to bear a penis and testicles, which excluded people like women and minorities. I'm of the opinion that the crafters of the Constitution were all too aware of the conundrum in which they found themselves. I again refer to the duplicitous task of setting down the God-given rights of the individual in an era when a great deal of the economy was largely dependent upon the use of slave labor. I should think that this particular moral pickle played an important part in the motion to make these documents correctable. I would liken the situation to the modern dilemma regarding our voracious consumption of fossil fuels. By now, we as a society have grown painfully aware that we are damaging our land and water and air irreparably via the extraction of fossil fuels such as coal, oil, and natural gas, as well as by the generous amounts of resultant waste products with which we pollute the planet. Yet, we continue to simply shrug, grin, and doggedly drive our monster trucks across the continent, whining to our mommies if we're unable to view the latest Disney fare on a TV screen in the back seat. We'll discuss more of that later. But the new American United States found themselves in just such a state of denial. It had dawned on the more enlightened members of the early legislation that perhaps these Africans who had been captured and sold like mules, and who were now being employed similarly like beasts of the field, bore an awfully uncanny resemblance to human beings. Really, it began to seem like these creatures from Africa were like human beings in damn near every way except for their darker skin pigmentation. Unfortunately, the notion of including these two-legged commodities of the slave labor system in the greater discussion of human rights was utterly unthinkable, since the larger part of the economy, particularly in the then most populous state, Virginia, was utterly reliant upon this labor force to keep their tobacco, cotton, and other crops profitable. If Madison had possessed the foresight to suggest that black people be included in this discussion of inalienable rights, he would likely have been taken out back and shot, presumed rabid or dangerously daft. Therefore, since he couldn't begin to address the massively looming issues of civil rights, he did the next best thing. He punted. Correctly predicting that our nation would grow and prosper at an astonishing rate, Madison and his collaborators equipped this new National Owner's Manual with a correctability. As though to say, I know there will be some problems that we couldn't get to in this initial Constitution, impressive though it may be, and so among its attributes will be its ability to be amended as time and progress require. The Bill of Rights was an astonishing innovation for its time. The first 10 amendments were an extremely effective security blanket that allowed the people to feel like their well-being was on the mind of the administration, which was a great way to get the people to vote for said administration. Some of the amendments are rather drier than others, or outdated at the least, since they had to do with our nation being at war on our home turf. An important distinction, considering that it's been more than 200 years now since we've had to worry about one if by land, two if by sea. So, for example, the Third Amendment, which reads, "No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house, without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law." It doesn't really have any effect on us, nor will it for the foreseeable future, barring some cataclysmic reversal of planetary fortunes. On the other hand, there are some amendments in that original 10 that are getting a great deal of attention. Let's roll through a few of these as a slight refresher, shall we? If you're anything like me, it may have been a while since you actually considered the letter of the law, as opposed to whatever it is your favorite pundit has been spouting. The First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Oh, hello. I believe the first part of this amendment refers to a notion I applaud loudly, the separation of church and state. Practice the religion of your choice, as you're free to do, and keep it out of the public arena. It seems worth remarking upon that this was the very first protection Madison awarded us American citizens. P.S. Those of you trying to recruit people to your religion may not be violating the actual written law, but you're certainly pissing all over the laws of common decency. Jesus would hang his beautiful Nubian head in shame. The second section, the one making mention of freedom of speech, has been of particular benefit in my life. For example, I'm free to pen the sentence, "Jesus would hang his beautiful Nubian head in shame," without fear of imprisonment, lynching, or, in the case of the Spanish Inquisition, being subjected to the Judas chair, the Spanish donkey, or the crocodile shears. All of which I would recommend you do not look up if you care to retain your lunch. These monstrous torture devices, in the name of the greater glory of the Catholic Church, no less, were once all the rage for punishing a blasphemer like myself, but not in America, you hypocritical sons of bitches. Thanks to our founding fathers, we can finally speak the truth without fear of chastisement on the part of our government. Generally speaking, that is. There have been periods in our history when subjects like communism, racial integration, Dixie Chicks lyrics, or most recently, terrorist activities / Muslim leanings could land you in some literal hot water. Boarding. Accepting those indiscretions or lapses in constitutional policy, whoopsie, we are free to speak or print the truth and also to speak or print utter bullshit. And it's up to the individual listener or reader to decide what he or she will swallow. Only in such a climate can free ideas be aired and exchanged, making the slow evolution of decency in our country possible. The Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay, this one has proven to be a regular can of worms. Let's just break it down. I think guns are an awfully nifty piece of engineering, and I have seen a great many examples of beautiful handwork in both the metal and wood surfaces on firearms of all sorts. Further, I support the wild game hunter much as I support the fisherman or woman. Beyond that use, I'm afraid the angry defenders of this amendment lose me. The preface to the part about to keep and bear arms makes reference to a well-regulated militia as the prerequisite to the second part. In other words, our civilians, as members of the militia who had been fiercely and proudly defending our country from the British and the French, as well as the indigenous peoples from whom we had just brutally stolen our land, should keep their black powder weapons at the ready in case we need to form up the militia once again should we be invaded by such an enemy. Unfortunately for the gun enthusiasts, this amendment is simply rendered moot by two undeniable factors. It was written in a time when we A, were potentially in danger of a foreign military invasion, and B, were wielding muzzle-loading guns that an expert could fire perhaps 5 times a minute, if he or she was very nimble. In other words, this amendment was penned when the revolver was still decades away from ready availability, let alone the massacre machine that is the automatic weapon. The rather loud machismo of the NRA, methinks the lady doth protest too much, on the topic of assault weapons seems like yet another antiquated, fear-based position that is being slowly eroded by a more genteel attitude of decency and compassion. It's worth noting that I don't see a lot of people who aren't white hollering about needing their guns to protect themselves, which brings me to a theory. Human beings are not simple. We are, in fact, quite complicated. In recent American history, we've engaged in such contradictions as owning slaves while declaring all people to have equal rights, while heading to church to pray for peace and tranquility, while dropping bombs on Middle Eastern nations to secure the oil we need to fuel our vehicles in order to drive to church. We're a mess. And we have to count ourselves as part of the whole because we're all complicit. So when I think about that time that we established our nation and economy while indulging in the unthinkable brutality of slavery, and then we also actively exterminated the Native American tribes across the continent because, well, they stood in the way of our real estate plans, and then we freed the slaves and didn't manage to wipe out all the indigenous people. In fact, we made them and every other race besides white people our equals as citizens, at least on paper, so they could come over to our houses and look us in the eye if they so choose. I can then understand why we're scared. It gives me fear as well to imagine the recompense that might be visited upon us should the suppressed rage of all the victims of the manifest destiny be brought to bear upon our doorsteps. It makes us cry with secret terror that we want our mommies or our guns or both. But then here's this other point of view. When unspeakable violence is enacted upon innocence, say in a school or a movie theater, and the survivors and the families of the victims in the throes of pain and anguish want to ask, why did this happen? How did this happen? And what can we do to prevent this from happening again? And one of the areas upon which they, still we, focus their scrutiny is that of the highly efficient weapons of warfare that are casually available to us citizens of the United States. Then we frightened gun lovers have the chance to be human and say, okay, this is a horrible tragedy. Let's open up a conversation here. Instead, I'm surmising out of fear, we throw up our defenses and behave in a very confrontational way towards such a conversation, citing the Second Amendment as the ultimate protection of our rights, no matter how ridiculously murderous the firearm, which unfortunately makes us look like total dicks. Clearly, if we could magically remove all the guns from the planet, we as a species would still occasionally want to kill one another. We're animalistic that way because despite having Netflix, we're animals. Taking away all the guns is not going to stop murder, just like making us remove our shoes at the airport is not going to stop terrorist acts. We may be animals, but we're exceedingly clever animals, so we'll find a way to do as we please, despite the law. We always have. If that's the case, then should we not, perhaps, try instead to examine the way we treat one another, so the chances that any of us want to shoot up a school are lessened? Finally, haven't we all learned from action movies and westerns that the ultimate hero is the one who needs no gun? True grit, real bravery, is exemplified by an open-handed confrontation, rendering the handshake or the embrace the ultimate method of laying waste to evil. If our foreign policy sees us engaging in nefarious and shameful and often just openly bullying practices to strong-arm other nations into giving us what we want, should we then be surprised when radical extremist factions of those nations fly planes into our buildings or commit other acts of retaliatory violence? And is the most effective method by which we might bring about the cessation of their hatred of us really to go and kill them right back? An eye for an eye, Hatfield and McCoy style? If the bravest protagonist is the one who lays down his or her weapon, then doesn't our desperate clinging to our guns make us cowards? I fear that if James Madison were to show up today, he'd be pretty depressed about what pedantic babies we've become in our handling of his excellent document. The last time we made any sort of amendment whatsoever was 1992, and it was just about what the members of Congress would be paid. We do an awful lot of griping about the flaws in our system, and yet the means by which we can change it are already in our possession. All we have to do is pay attention. Chapter 4. The Orator, Frederick Douglass. Hey, it's a black guy. Relatively speaking, by which I mean in the grand scheme of recorded history, the historical period containing American slavery occurred about 15 minutes ago. When I was an actual book-learning student in my teens and 20s, these early years of America's development seemed like they occurred eons ago, perhaps shortly after the dinosaurs made their undignified exit. As I have achieved the more cantankerous age of 44, however, and I think back to purchasing my first Kurt Vonnegut book or my first Tom Robbins, nay, my first Duran Duran record 30 years ago. And then I consider the fact that Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 occurred a mere factor of 5 times since I was first besotted with the song Hungry Like the Wolf, I realize just how recently we modern Americans actually engaged in such depravity. When I began to compile the list of possible subjects for my book, the flaws in my own proclivities quickly emerged. For example, my editor, Jill, told me that, although Chicago Cubs legendary second baseman Ryan Sandberg had indeed turned in a most impressive career, both at the plate, 277 career home runs, and in the infield, 9 gold gloves, 989 career fielding percentage, his contribution was perhaps too specialized for the general audience, by which she means what, dullards? Soccer fans? Discussing Rhino, she asserted, would be literally too inside baseball. However, it almost immediately occurred to me that I would want to talk about some assorted social issues like racism and slavery, gender inequality, homophobia, red meat rights, and so forth, and so I argued that I could find all of these peccadilloes fully represented in a comprehensive history of the Chicago Cubs Major League Baseball team, widely regarded as the greatest team in the history of the sport, after next year's season. Just you wait and see. What is probably quite clear to you by now is that Jill did not approve the Cubby's gumption idea. I would need to extend my gaze beyond the friendly confines of Wrigley Field. Despite the overall laudatory tone of the first three chapters, I have also hinted at some of the more shameful episodes surrounding our nation's beginnings, and so I thought it would be only fair, yea, and balanced, to examine those darker spots with closer scrutiny. Yes, our founding fathers did some amazing head-scratching, hollering, and ultimately heroic document scribbling, but they also engaged fulsomely in, for example, the horrific practice known as slavery. From that purview, then, it is not surprising that I should next be enthralled with Frederick Douglass. So, in 2005, when Ryan Sandberg was inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame, he spoke stirringly about paying the appropriate respect to the game of baseball, whether one is belting a home run or laying down a sacrifice bunt. In a final selfless turn, he also campaigned for a similar induction into Cooperstown on behalf of his former Cub teammate, the great Andre Dawson, a.k.a. the Hawk. It occurs to me, Jill, that I can metaphorically include Ryan Sandberg's virtues in my book if I, a white guy, similarly get behind Frederick Douglass, a black guy, for induction into my own personal gumption hall of fame. If we are agreed, then, upon this apt comparison, let us proceed. Go Cubs, go. I had known the basic outline of Douglass' story, namely that he was a famous orator and abolitionist who had begun his life as a slave. As is the case for so many topics in the distant safety of my Midwestern history class, however, I never really thought about what that journey entailed from a simply human point of view. I thought, okay, he was a slave, which was a total bummer, then he escaped to freedom. And it turned out he was smart, smart as shit, in fact. So he did some orator stuff, so then he was not as bummed out. Upon revisiting his story, however, I could not help but gape at the details my soft, privileged ass had not previously digested. Frederick Douglass was born into slavery on the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland, never knew his father, who was rumored to have been his master, and was seldom allowed to see his mother, since it was common custom to part mothers from their children at a very small age. He guesses he was born in 1818, but was never certain of his age because not only were slaves disallowed to learn to read and write, they were also not taught things like the months or years of the calendar. After his mother died, he was sent to Baltimore to serve at the house of one Hugh Auld. Auld's wife, Sophia, a kind woman, began teaching young Frederick the alphabet, despite the Maryland state law that forbade teaching a slave to read. When her husband found out about these lessons, he was outraged, and she was strongly admonished, not with a whip or anything, but probably some pretty stern talking, because Hugh held, as did the status quo, that literacy would ruin a slave, as he would become dissatisfied with his condition and desire freedom. This statement sadly infers that the slaves were otherwise satisfied with their conditions, which means that these white folks must have been either deeply stupid or viciously evil or quite possibly both. Frederick Douglass possessed a prodigious intellect, which, like an ineludible superpower,